So today we're going to begin, continue our discussion of Mark. If you'll turn to Mark chapter 6, we're going to talk about two events which are related by Mark to each other, as we shall see as we read and discuss these. Mark chapter 6, starting with verse 30. Then the apostles gathered around Jesus and told him everything they had done and taught. He said to them, "Come with me privately to an isolated place and rest a while." For many were coming and going, and there was no time to eat. So they went away by themselves in a boat to some remote place. But many saw them leaving and recognized them, and they hurried on foot from all the towns and arrived there ahead of them. As Jesus came ashore, he saw the large crowd, and he had compassion on them, because they were like sheep without a shepherd. So he taught them many things. When it was late, his disciples came to him and said, "This is an isolated place, and it is already very late. Send them away so that they can go into the surrounding countryside and villages and buy something for themselves to eat." But he answered them, "You give them something to eat." And they said, "Should we go and buy bread for 200 silver coins and give it to them to eat?" He said to them, "How many loaves do you have? Go and see." When they found out, they said, "Five and two fish." Then he directed them all to sit down in groups on the green grass. So they reclined in groups of hundreds and fifties. He took the five loaves and two fish. Looking up to heaven, he gave thanks and broke the loaves. He gave them to his disciples to serve the people, and he divided the two fish among them all. They all ate and were satisfied, and they picked up the broken pieces and fish that were left over, 12 baskets full. Now there were 5,000 men who ate the bread. And after we discuss this passage, we'll talk about the next one and read it. So here's the scene. We've just had Jesus sending out the disciples, right, two by two, as his emissaries, preaching his message with his power, casting out demons, doing healings, that basic kind of idea. That was their mission. Then we had this little interlude about John the Baptist and Herod and his death, which Tim talked about last week. So now we're coming back and we're picking up the story again, where it says here at the very beginning, then the disciples gathered around Jesus and told him everything they had done and taught. So now we're coming back. Apparently one of the side effects of this sending out of his apostles was an increased amount of popularity. As you can see here, we're going to have a very large number of people coming out to see Jesus. And if you look, it said, was it 4,000 or was it 5,000 men? 5,000 men. And, of course, that's just the men, right? There were probably women there. And, you know, the men, they can go by themselves. But if the women come, the children have to come too. You know how that is, right? And so you've actually got a lot more people than just 5,000. Yes, that is how it works. Sad but true. I'm not making exceptions myself. That's how it works for me the same way. So you've actually got a large number of people. Was it 10,000? Was it 12,000? It probably wouldn't have been more. But still, you've got a very large crowd around Jesus. And due to its placement, I think this probably has something to do with Jesus sending out of the 12. You know, Jesus can only be at one place at one time as an incarnate human being, right? And so he can preach to a small group of people. But if you just send out six more groups along with him, the movement that is gathering around Jesus is going to grow rather quickly. So you've got this happening here. So they come, and Jesus is feeling sorry for them because they are like sheep without a shepherd. They don't have a good leader, a good godly leader. Herod, obviously, is not the leader that they need, correct? And the Jews didn't like Herod very much. Herod was very despicable to them, and as he should have been. So they really didn't have a leader, which is one reason why there were other, you know, messiahs during this time. They were always looking for someone to follow. And Jesus, of course, was the correct one. So Jesus felt compassion on them because they were like sheep without a shepherd. And so it's getting late in the day, and the disciples are, hey, you know, these guys are hungry. It's getting late in the day. I don't have that much food with me, so let's send them away. And so Jesus says, well, don't send them away. You feed them. And so they're like, well, should we take all our money and go buy some food? And he's like, what do you have? And so they bring a little bit and says, this is all we have. We have a few loaves and a few fish. And, of course, then we get the miracle of the feeding, where Jesus breaks up this food and it multiplies before their eyes. And it's enough to more than fill everybody in the crowd. Now, and this may seem out of context right now, but this will make sense in a minute. Do you think the disciples noticed that this was a miracle? Right away. I mean, it's fairly obvious, right? You're breaking bread. You're passing around. You'll see in a minute why I mentioned that. And so you've got a pretty interesting scene here, right? So you now have Jesus has done a new miracle. This is something he has not done before, right? He's healed people. He's cast out demons. He's done quite a bit more. He's accidentally healed people, right? You know, with the lady with the issue of blood comes up, touches him. In a sovereign sense, Jesus intended this. But really, it was just his power and her faith that connected to do this. So a lot of things has happened, but this is actually new. And there are some things we can learn about this. One, you know, we can look at the disciples and we can say, okay, disciples, well, that's sort of like us. And so when Jesus says, you, disciples, you feed them, right? This is in a sense a command to us to say, you know, we should feed the people. One of the obvious ways would be to say physically. If we have people that cannot support themselves, well, obviously we need to feed them. But then spiritually, you could bring that out as well and say, okay, well, we also need to feed people spiritually. That's the function of the church, correct? And so that is generally how people look at this passage, and it's fairly straightforward, and it totally makes sense. But, and we're going to come back to this passage, I don't think that's why this passage is here at all. Good applications to draw from it. That's the obvious, clear meaning. You look at the next passage, though, you get a clue that that's not what's going on. So walking on water, verse 45. Immediately, Jesus made his disciples get into the boat and go on ahead to the other side, to Bethsaida, while he dispersed the crowd. After saying goodbye to them, he went to the mountain to pray. When evening came, the boat was in the middle of the sea, and he was alone on the land. He saw them straining at the oars because the wind was against them. As the night was ending, he came to them walking on the sea, for he wanted to pass by them. When they saw him walking on the water, they thought he was a ghost. They cried out, for they all saw him and were terrified. But immediately he spoke to them. Have courage, it is I. Do not be afraid. Then he went up with them into the boat, and the wind ceased. They were completely astonished, because they did not understand about the loaves, but their heart was hardened. So have we yet had in Mark a miracle that involves Jesus in water? Have we seen this yet? In Mark. Have we seen this? Where have we seen this? No, that's John. All right? Haven't we had the calming of the seas? Right? Haven't we had that? Believe we had? Okay. Yeah, I thought it was my head. There it is. End of chapter 4. All right, so we've already had a water miracle by Mark, right? By Jesus in Mark. And so in some senses, this shouldn't be too surprising. We've already seen Jesus dealing with nature, where nature's all in a ruckus. There's lots of wind. There's lots of waves. Jesus says, be still, and immediately it's still. Incredibly miraculous. The disciples kind of freak out because they really don't know how to understand this. Notice what's at the end of this passage. Then he went up with them into the boat, and the wind ceased. They were completely astonished because they did not understand about the loaves, because their heart was hardened. Not because they did not understand about the previous miracle of Jesus on the sea. Okay, so you see what Mark is doing. He's actually tying this with the loaves. And so what does that mean? That's the question of the day. What does it mean? Because they did not understand about the loaves. Now let's talk about this passage. Is walking on water a big deal? Yes. I think we can assume that's a big deal. All right? This in many ways strikes me as distinctly, I don't know, more significant, different, greater than a healing or a casting out of a demon, maybe not of a resurrection. But in a lot of these things, this is pretty amazing, right? And the disciples saw this as well. I mean, there's no statement about them being completely amazed about the multiplication of the food. But there is here, and they should be. This is scary. This is strange because people don't do this, right? And so Mark ties it together and he says, because they did not understand the loaves. Now, what is it about the breaking of the loaves and the fish that would make them understand this. And I don't think it's the fact that Jesus multiplied food, because the ability to multiply food to me does not necessarily lead to the ability to walk on water, right? I mean, the ability to control nature, that makes sense, because he's already controlled water, and he's already controlled air. But the ability to multiply food, if that's really what that passage is about, doesn't really follow. So now I'm going to argue why that passage isn't really about that at all. So if you look at it, and this is where I'm going to need you who are using different translations than I am. Look back at verse 31. He said to them, come with me privately to an isolated place and rest a while. In 32, so they went away by themselves in a boat to some remote place. Or 35, when it was already late, his disciples came to him and said, this is an isolated place. And it was already late. Okay? So this is what we have. We have remote. Well, that's not going to work. Try this. There we go. We have a remote place, isolated place. All right, these are actually the same word in Greek. They just translate it two different ways in these three instances. What do you guys see in your translations? Desert. What version is that? KJV? Okay. Anybody have anything different than the KJV?
Solitary.
Solitary? What you got? What do you have? What translation?
NIV.
Okay. What has desolate?
Deserted.
What has deserted? KJV? New King James Version. And then desolate. ESV? Okay. Remote place, isolated place, desert, solitary, deserted, and desolate. The word here, and you Greekophiles, do you remember what this word means? No? It means those things. Very good. Very good. Very good. All right. There's a few words that you might know. We, a few months ago, we talked about the monastic movements, right? We talked about the Cenobitic versus the Eremitic monks, okay? Or we get our word hermit from this same word. All right. What it doesn't mean is it doesn't mean desert, okay? What it really means is deserted or isolated or remote, wilderness. When we think of wilderness, we think jungle. For them, it's just there's nobody around, right? There's no civilization. You're not likely to run across a well to get water. You're not going to find a town or things like that. It's out in the middle of nowhere. So that's the setting. And as you see, Mark makes a point of mentioning that three times. All right? I don't think that's on accident. Now, let's bring in some other things. Okay, so we have some deserted place, a wilderness place. What else do we have here? We have a large number of Jews, right? Race is important here. Okay, large number of Jews, isolated desert place. Miraculous delivery of food. Now, think back in the Old Testament. Can you think of any place in the Old Testament that was significant that had a large number of Jews, they were in the wilderness, and there was a miraculous delivery of food? The Exodus. Okay. And so this is how this makes sense to me. Because if it's just he can create food, that's significant, no doubt. But not to me saying this man can therefore walk on water. But if this figure, this human being, okay, is doing what some figure in the Old Testament did for the nation of God, right? That's something else entirely. Now the question is, who is it? I can think of two potential beings that he could be in this case. Who would that be? Moses or Moses or Yahweh. Okay? So what Mark is trying to do here, by this editorial comment of, they didn't understand this. Okay? They didn't understand the significance of this. Was he was saying this. Okay? This makes sense to me. And when you see it, when I see it, I can't get away from it now. I see it and I go, this is obvious what this means. And this is why Mark put the editorial comment in, I think. Because he wants people to go back and think about it and say, don't miss it. They didn't understand the loaves. They didn't get it. Okay? And so if you think it's just about little miracle, personally, I don't think you get it either. It's this. It's Jesus is either being called Moses, who, does Moses have any power over water in the Old Testament? Part of the Red Sea. Once again, you get food in the wilderness and water here juxtaposed. Different order, but right beside each other. Doesn't strike me as coincidence, right? Either Moses or the actual source of his power, which is Yahweh. So, does that make sense? Sure, where I'm coming with that. That is totally, in my mind, the fuller meaning of this. You know, and I don't think it's one of those places where you had your scripture writers, like in the Old Testament, who were talking, who did not understand exactly what was going on. They just spoke what they thought, and then we find out later, oh, well, this is Christ. I think this is exactly what Mark is trying to do. And if you look at the next miracle defeating, you will also notice there that there is an emphasis on the fact that it is in a deserted place. I think that's in the next chapter or two. Anyway, so the question is, who is this saying Jesus is? Is he saying it's Moses or Yahweh? So think through the passage now. Now with this paradigm of we're looking for who this is, think through the food and also the water. What do you think? Yeah. Very decisive answer there. Anybody else? Let's think about it. All right? We had the food. Of course, Moses did not himself deliver the food, did he? No. Okay? Yahweh delivered the food. All right. Did Moses split the Red Sea, right? Of course, it wasn't really his power. We know that. It was a very strong east wind, yes. Yes. Well, that seems more, you know, more of a Moses to me, because he did actually, you know, split the sea. Of course, we know it was God. We know it was his power. Is there anything else about this that reminds you of the Exodus narrative that would help us think through this? Where was Jesus before he walked out on the water? Where? Mountain. Was Moses ever on a mountain? Where? Okay. Of course, God was up there too, right? Moses, he was up on a mountain. Okay? For a while, the people are doing something else. He comes down. Okay, is there anything else? When Moses came down from the mountain, was everything normal with Moses? With him. Obviously, the people in this situation are very different, right? When Moses came down, people were being idolaters. Here, they're not, right? But as far as the character here, whether Yahweh or Moses, was there anything special about Moses when he came down from the mountain? He glowed. And what was the response of the people? They were very afraid. Okay? So we have Moses, because of his encounter with God, was incredibly terrifying as a being. What were the disciples' reaction when they saw Jesus coming out in the water? They were like, this is scary, right? Ghost, something coming across the water. Anything else? That's all I've got. That's all I've been able to think of. But that's plenty to me, right? So it's not just that they're in a desert and there was a large number of Jews and miraculous, you know, creation of food. Well, there was water. Moses was on a mountain to receive the law. And whenever Moses came down from the mountain, he was incredibly terrifying. I think all of this is on purpose. It would strike me as odd. All of this was coincidental. So what this means is this. These two stories in Mark's narrative go together. And what Mark is saying is, and I think this really leads us toward Moses, even though I think there might be implications of that too, which we've seen elsewhere in Mark anyway. But I think the point of Mark in this is Jesus is the new Moses. The other one, the statement at the very end of the first paragraph that we just read, and Jesus came ashore, he saw a large crowd and he had compassion on them because they were like sheep without a shepherd. So Jesus is the shepherd who is really the shepherd of the people of Israel. Right? Moses. Another parallel. So you see this, right? So that's what this passage is about. And you have to see it. But once you see it, it totally makes sense, right? And that's what Mark is saying. Jesus is the new Moses. Right? We've already talked about this Exodus narrative before. We've already talked about the Isaianic narrative of the redemption of the people of God from captivity, from sin. This is what Mark is continuing to say. Jesus is the Moses that is delivering his people from their sin. Make sense? Now, you can, of course, draw other things from this. Like I said, there are some lessons we could certainly learn about how we are to deal with the poor in our own body and those outside. And there's, of course, spiritual lessons to learn there as well. We do need to feed people, which is, of course, what Jesus was doing, which is, of course, why people were following him, because they were being fed and they were seeing a shepherd, right? But in terms of what Mark is trying to do, this strikes me as fairly, fairly clear. Jesus is the new Moses and the new lawgiver. Is that significant? So what happened? So there's the promise of Abraham, right? And so God promised Abraham, I'm going to give you what? Right. I'm going to give you land. I'm going to give you lots of children, and I'm going to bless you, essentially is what he said. And so what you get with the covenant at Mount Sinai is you're really getting sort of a sub-fulfillment of the promise to Abraham. It's God gathering the people of God together and saying, here, a nation, I create you now. Here's your charter, the Ten Commandments. You shall love your God, and go down the list, and this is exactly how you are to behave, right? And then, of course, the unfolding of the rest of the law and the Torah in the Old Testament, all of this is about creating this group of people saying, you are, boom, here I define you. You are the people of God. And so what this means is, if there's a new Moses, what do you have? You've got a new law, and you've got a new people. Of course, it starts with this, right? Jesus' mission, the very first, was to Jews, not to Gentiles. As we've seen a little bit before, and as we'll see later, obviously it has greater ramifications than that, right? Whenever he went and healed the demoniac, that was in Gentile territory. He was already invading, okay? Whenever we see the Syrophoenician woman, we'll see Jesus, if you remember the story, trying to repel her, but then she's just so insistent, and he says, this is exactly the kind of faith that, you know, someone needs, right? But it starts with this. And so what the author is saying is, Jesus is, and given our theology, this is not terribly surprising, and given what we've seen, not terribly surprising, that Jesus is the new Moses, he is creating a new people, and he's going to be leaving a new law. Now, you see a lot more of the new law stuff in Matthew, because you get a lot more teaching, and you also see it in Luke. In Mark, there's not a ton. There's some, but not a ton. But the emphasis is still there in Mark. And as the early Christians would be reading this is exactly what they would be thinking. in 60 or 70 AD when this was written, they're going to be thinking, okay, this is Jesus as the new Moses starting a new people, and that's what we are. We're the new people of God. Any questions about that? Right, and that's why I made the story, made the point earlier of they would have noticed this. This is fairly obvious. And some people said, well, you know, you don't see them saying anything at the end of the feeding, and so that must not, they must not have realized it was a miracle. That seems strange to me. And the point in the water story is they didn't understand it. Yeah. Didn't say they didn't see it. They just didn't get it.
I think the other thing that's,
I told you that before. No, he actually listens to me the first time. Every time I ever say anything, he gets it completely. Yeah, we've never had that issue.
Right. Yeah. We also see this as a metaphor for.
And I do think your point about nation of Israel being a parallel to disciples, I do think we should focus on that a little bit, because that's exactly, I mean, why did Jesus choose 12, right? It's not because 12 was a necessarily convenient number. It's because the 12, this is, I'm gathering around what? The new heads of the nation of Israel. This is my new people, symbolically, right here. The nation of Israel and the new nation of Israel, both confused, even while they were being delivered. It wasn't, I mean, the old nation of Israel never really got it. The new nation of Israel didn't get it until after the resurrection. And at that point, it snapped. It all fit together, and the new nation was what God had intended, right? Where before, you know, you get the promises in the major prophets, where, you know, before, you would disobey me, but you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to write my law on your heart so that you will obey me. And so here we see the fulfillment. But that hasn't happened yet. They still don't get it. That's not going to happen until later, till the Spirit comes. The law is written on the heart. And then they go, bang. We are the people of God. We will obey God. And then they actually do. But I think that's a great parallel because that's exactly what's happening here. Israel and Israel. And about this point as well. Surely your heart wouldn't be hardened after you've seen so much unless softening of the heart is not something that men do. If God would just come and do a miracle in front of everybody, surely they would all believe. And clearly that's not true. Right? Because it's not, I mean, God can use a miracle to reach people, and he did clearly at this time in Jesus' ministry all of the time. But the miracle won't do it. Just the seeing of a miracle, no matter how obvious it is, because some of these things are really obvious. You can't, I mean, people have tried to come up with, you know, really silly naturalistic explanations of how Jesus could walk on water. Well, right there, it was just really shallow, and so Jesus was walking. And then, well, why are the, you know, disciples worried about the waves and the wind? And it makes no sense to me, right? You can't really explain this. And when you get to something that you can't explain, you would think, logically from a human perspective, well, people will just get it at that point and just believe. But still their hearts were hardened, which means that's not how it works. You don't just get it because you see a miracle. You get it because something else happens, which, of course, Mark doesn't say here, but, yeah. And that's a good place to end.